From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've seen a lot of Republicans at the podium this primary season. Last night, it was the president's turn. Biggest podium in the land. It's been rough, he said, but things are turning up, and there's no turning around.
The state of our union is getting strong, and we've come too far to turn back now.
President Obama was not taking the class warfare label, but he was asking more of the rich, looking to steal some GOP thunder on energy and China, looking to make an economy, he said, that is built to last, looking, it was clear, toward re-election. This hour on point, the president's State of the Union and his blueprints for an economy and his 2012 campaign. You can join the conversation. Is the president on the money? Did he describe what you see going on in the union, where you want to go? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a great crew with us today from Washington. Ryan Liz is here, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. His big piece in the current issue is the Obama memos, the making of a post-partisan presidency. Ryan Liz, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
From Athens, Georgia, Cynthia Tucker is here, longtime Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, now a visiting professor at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication. Cynthia Tucker, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Tom.
And from Bethesda, Maryland, Doyle McManus, Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Doyle McManus, great to have you back as well.
Good to be with you.
Let's listen to just a little more of the president last night, drawing maybe his main line in the sand here, saying he wants to keep the promise of the American dream alive for all Americans.
We can either settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number of Americans barely get by. Or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot, and everyone does their fair share, and everyone plays by the same set of rules.
Doyle McManus, let me come first to you. Here's the president's big framing. He wants to create a choice right there. The Republicans want to create a choice, too. Did it sound effective the way he put this picture to the American people, something for everybody in my camp, not in the other camp?
Well, it did sound effective, and there was one interesting rhetorical shift that is worth noting. You know, when the president outlined his new populism a month or so ago in Osawatomie, Kansas, It sounded like a speech about inequality. And there was a focus there on the injustice of having allowed so many people to make so much money while leaving so many behind. Last night, in this State of the Union, the president was talking much more about fairness, about equality of opportunity, about having everybody play by the same rules. It was a little more Clintonian than what we had heard before.
Cynthia Tucker, the Republicans came right back in the form of Mitch Daniels and called him a divisive class warfare guy anyway. Do you think the president can succeed in pushing his framing onto this race?
Well, it's no surprise that that's what the Republicans came back with. That's what they've been saying for the last several months as Occupy Wall Street around the country has brought the issue of income inequality to the forefront. Let me say, though, that I think that the way the president framed the issue last night is broadly popular, certainly popular with liberals, but also with swing voters. Polls show that increasing taxes on millionaires is broadly popular with voters. So in that sense, yes, I think the president will be successful in the way he framed it last night.
Ryan, Liz, listen with us to a little more from the president. He said, class warfare, no, common sense, but he does want to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans, including the so-called Buffett rule, which would mean higher rates effectively on folks making more than $1 million. Here's the president in the midst of his State of the Union address.
Do we want to keep these tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, or do we want to keep our investments in everything else, like education and medical research, a strong military, and care for our veterans? Because if we're serious about paying down our debt, we can't do both.
You can have a strong country across that kind of spectrum, he said, or you can have lower taxes for the wealthiest Americans. He said you cannot have both. And then this on the class warfare accusation.
Now, you can call this class warfare all you want, but asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes? Most Americans would call that common sense.
Ryan Lizzie, is he right? How's that play?
You know, my view of this, Tom, is that over the last four decades, there have been two dramatic trends, one economic and one political. The economic trend, the one that's been really brought home by the Occupy Wall Street movement, has been growing inequality. And the political trend is growing polarization. That is that the two parties have grown more homogenous and more ideologically distinct and distant from one another. Obama's never really been one, address inequality head on. He's never been a comfortable class warrior, although lots of his policies certainly address inequality. And his view of polarization has always been that it was something that he could overcome and, in fact, would overcome. I think this speech marks a turning point in Obama addressing both of those quite dramatic issues. One, there were some lines in there, not really so much about working together with Congress, although there was some of that, but a little bit more emphasis on the obstruction of Congress, on reforming the Senate. So
you haven't done this. You haven't done that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and I will fight you. And then, as you've pointed out with some of these clips, a much more emphasis, although not, you know, we shouldn't exaggerate it, but definitely, certainly more emphasis on issues of fairness and equality. And I think both of those things are very significant.
Of course, the class warfare label has been central to a bunch of GOP campaigns. Mitt Romney's had it right out front. Newt Gingrich has made no little noise about it. Last night in the Republican response, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels was right on that theme. Here he was, despite what the president had just said in his State of the Union address, here's Republican Mitch Daniels.
No feature of the Obama presidency has been sadder than its constant efforts to divide us, to curry favor with some Americans by castigating others. As in previous moments of national danger, we Americans are all in the same boat. If we drift, quarreling and paralyzed over a Niagara of debt, we will all suffer.
Nothing sadder than the constant effort to divide us coming right after, I thought, Doyle, the president was saying he didn't want to divide us. He just wanted common sense. How's that Republican message play up against the president's speech?
Well, that is what we're going to have to see, because what one of the core Republican messages, and we've heard it from Mitt Romney as well as Newt Gingrich and Mitch Daniels, is exactly that any talk of raising taxes on one part of the country, on wealthy taxpayers or in some cases non-taxpayers, is inherently divisive and is pitting one class against another. Now, what the polls show, actually, is that Republicans strongly agree with the Republican message, not surprisingly. Yep. Democrats strongly agree with the Democratic message. Independents are divided, but they lean quite heavily, in a majority, toward the view that, yes, the wealthy aren't paying their fair share. And I think in this respect, the president was enormously lucky that he was delivering his message on the same day that Mitt Romney belatedly released his tax returns and showed that he was paying less than the 15% tax rate he had estimated. Mm-hmm. It was actually about 14%. And in a number that may actually have impressed people more, that his income is running roughly $21 million a year. That's the kind of helpful backup that the president didn't have to refer to explicitly, but it was in the minds of much of his audience that may actually help his message resonate.
20 plus million in the Romney income side of the ledger last year and 13.9% taxes. Enviable, though the president said America's not about envy. Let's just make it fair. Cynthia Tucker, step back with us for a second here. What did you see going on in that great hall last night? You know, at times during this presidency, there was even talk that Barack Obama might not have the heart for it. He said early on that if things weren't coming back strong by the time he was 3 years in, he shouldn't have another term. Did you see a man determined to go out and win again, Cynthia?
Absolutely. I saw a man who was more combative at times in that speech than he has usually been. He has been that way occasionally on the campaign trail, but certainly not in a State of the Union speech, not when he's addressing Congress. For his supporters, that was heartening, because some of his supporters questioned whether he had the heart or the stomach for the kind of all-out brawl that this campaign is likely to be for him. But let me say something else about this whole class warfare business. The message of class warfare has been enormously successful for Republicans in the past. Even as income inequality has been increasing for 40 years now, pushing back against any talk about income inequality has been effective for Republicans because most Americans were still doing well. They were still doing well because they used their credit cards to make up for the gap they were left with in stagnant wages. Suddenly, we've hit a different time. This recession left people jobless. Their houses, even if they held on to them, going down in value. So suddenly they felt poorer, their credit card debt mounting up, and credit not as easy to come by. So they are feeling the income inequality in a way that they haven't felt it over the last 40 years. And so this message of class warfare may not do as well for Republicans as it has done in the past.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the State of the Union, President Obama's perspective, his blueprint, his campaign platform, in effect, last night on display there on Capitol Hill. Ryan Lizza is with us, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Doyle McManus from the Los Angeles Times is here. Cynthia Tucker, long time at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Pulitzer Prize winner there, now at the University of Georgia, with us today from Athens, Georgia. The president looked back across the years since his election, the hole the economy was in, where it's come since then, was particularly happy to talk about the fact that GM has become once again the biggest automaker in the world. Auto industry is back, and he said in his speech it can happen for other American manufacturers.
We bet on American workers. We bet on American ingenuity. And tonight, the American auto industry is back. What's happening in Detroit can happen in other industries. It can happen in Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Raleigh. We can't bring every job back that's left our shore. But right now, it's getting more expensive to do business in places like China. Meanwhile, America is more productive. A few weeks ago, the CEO of Masterlock told me that it now makes business sense for him to bring jobs back home.
Bring the jobs back home. And a lot of talk last night about manufacturing. Now, you know, Doyle McManus, if you look back a few years, that's kind of surprising. There was such a long stretch where we were told that's not America's thing anymore. We're a service economy now, and that's all right. And yet we've got this big unemployment. America put, I mean, President Obama put it front and center along with energy. A lot of talk about fossil fuels and clean energy. Manufacturing and the auto industry, can we really look at that as an example of something that will be available on a bigger scale to the whole country to float the economy, Doyle?
Well, alas, what economists tell us is, in the large scale, probably not. You know, manufacturing has bounced back since the depths of the recession. There have been more than 300,000 manufacturing jobs created in the last year. But the problem is that over the long run, it's still shrinking as a share of the economy. So it was kind of surprising from an economic perspective that the president said that manufacturing was going to be the cornerstone of this new America built to last. And incidentally, it's no accident that that slogan came from Detroit, too. That was the old GM truck slogan.
Right.
I think, though, we got to look at this from the political perspective. Mm-hmm. One of the constituencies that the president clearly intends to fight for, and there has been some controversy over this, is white blue-collar men. That's a constituency that has gone Republican ever since the days of Ronald Reagan, but it's critical how many go Republican and how many go to the Democrats. Barack Obama was quite successful in capturing a share of those voters back in 2008. He did better among white blue-collar workers than John Kerry had 4 years earlier. This was, in a political sense, in a little bit of an inside baseball sense, partly a declaration by Barack Obama that he's going to talk to those voters about what they want. And one of the things that resonates obviously among blue-collar workers is, do you care about manufacturing jobs? Mm-hmm. It was something that helped among, of all people, Rick Santorum in the state of New Hampshire. There was an idea in the Obama speech, a lower corporate tax rate for companies that do manufacturing, that he borrowed directly from Rick Santorum.
Here he is saying, I care about you, blue collar man, and we can do it. I mean, I want to look at that. There was this claim in the middle of it. He said also, we'll go after, and this is some of the Romney message that Obama was adopting last night, we'll go after people who cheat on trade, we'll go after China, and if we can level the playing field, here was his promise.
Our workers are the most productive on earth, and if the playing field is level, I promise you, America will always win.
If the playing field is level, America will always win. Now, I hope that sounds great, Ryan Lizza. Is that true? Is he just playing to the blue-collar worker out there? You know, there's a lot of competition even on a level playing field these days.
No, it's not true. If the playing field is level, it doesn't mean we'll always win. But, you know, if you're president of the United States, you have to root for America no matter what. And that's, you know, fair enough. You know, the one interesting fact about this State of the Union, when I was going through some of these memos from 2009 and 2010, there was a series of exchanges between Obama's aides and the president. And David Axelrod wrote him a memo saying, we don't want your 2010 State of the Union, which was his first one, to be a laundry list of policies. We want it to be about big, bold themes. Well, last night was the laundry list, mm-hmm. right? This was the series of policies, some of which he's presented before and has not passed, but many of which you really saw the hand of the political advisors. You really, you know, if you read between the lines, you could see him trying to address vulnerabilities, trying to lay out ideas that will help him in the general election. And he benefits right now from, of course, not having a primary. His message last night was completely pitched to the general election, mm-hmm. Themes that he'll use. Whereas the Republican candidates, Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, do debate after debate where, you know, they have to appeal to the base of their party. They have to attack one another. So he's really in this commanding position right now vis-a-vis the presidential campaign.
I want to ask about some of those pieces on the laundry list. Big among them was infrastructure. Obama has tried again and again to do a lot of that. A lot has been spent on that. But last night, Cynthia Tucker, he said, in the Great Depression, we built the Hoover Dam and the Golden Gate Bridge. Then in the 50s, the interstate highway system. And here was his line on what to do about deficit, but also spending for nation building at home.
In the next few weeks, I will sign an executive order clearing away the red tape that slows down too many construction projects. But you need to fund these projects. Take the money we're no longer spending at war, use half of it to pay down our debt, and use the rest to do some nation building right here at home.
Who wouldn't applaud that? But Cynthia Tucker, is there a chance of that and a lot of other things here being done? You know, take that, whatever it is, $1 trillion a year or something you might say we've been spending on war, spend half of it on infrastructure, construction of home, or is that just a talking point to take up against whoever the Republican contender ends up being?
Well, it's certainly not going to get done in 2012. Very little will get accomplished in 2012 if it has to go through Congress. You know, one of the places where you see the effect of bitter polarization in Congress is on the subject of infrastructure. Because if you ask Democrats in Congress, Republicans in Congress, entities that big lobbying groups, trade groups that support Republicans like the Chamber of Commerce, they're all for infrastructure rebuilding, spending on infrastructure. There is very little disagreement about that as a big mega idea, but it gets bogged down in the details. How do we pay for it? Who do we tax to pay for it if we tax anybody? Republicans are often opposed to the use of requiring the use of union labor. Democrats want union labor if it's going to be supported by federal dollars. So while in general everybody talks about infrastructure, it is unlikely to get done a bill passed supporting this in 2012. Let me also say something about the laundry list, which was my least favorite thing about the speech. But on the Obama also did a lot of played a lot of defense in mm-hmm. terms of the general election campaign. And one of the places where he did that was in talking about China. Mitt Romney in particular has done a lot of tough talking about China. This hits at the core of the American working class who feel under threat from offshoring. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that this is one of those places where, unless you want to ignite a trade war, there is very little Mitt Romney could do as president or Barack Obama could do. That's just plain politics.
Doyle, what about, he talked a lot about leveraging American companies back home. Favor those who bring jobs home with tax breaks, punish those or penalize those who take jobs abroad. Does the executive alone have the power to do some of that? Could Congress restructure taxes so that it would seriously turn the tide? I mean, he says it's already happening, but could it really be sped up by policy out of Washington? Doyle?
We lost Doyle.
Oh, we lost Earl. Ryan, I'll give it to you.
Sounds like it. Yeah, you know, not to keep going back to this, but some of these tax proposals do go back to Obama's first budget. And as I was, you know, at one point in 2009, as they were preparing their next budget, Obama's advisors, Larry Summers mm-hmm. and Timothy Geithner, came to him and said, "Mr. President, these tax proposals about getting jobs back in the U.S. and these taxes on multinational corporations, very similar to the ones that were presented last night, we have discussed these with the business lobby and they hate them. And you have a decision to make here. We've sat down with the representatives of the business community, and we feel like we have responded to their most reasonable concerns, and we've scaled back your tax proposals by about $16 billion out of, I think, a $150 billion package."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they take him through this, and they say, "Mr. President, you can go with our scaled back package, but only do it." Very interesting, almost challenging Obama. "Only do this if you're willing to personally defend it. Otherwise, it's not worth the political capital."
And he
if
said,
"You don't want to." And they gave him another option. They said, "If you don't want to do that, you can just. We have a third. Or we have a second option here, which would definitely be seen as caving." They used the word caving to the business community, and it would be a dramatically scaled back package. And next to that paragraph, the President of the United States writes, "worth discussing."
That's kind of ambivalent response.
That's right. So it shows his thought process that, you know, he was being pilloried at that point as anti-business, and he was genuinely taking into consideration the concerns of this community. In the end, he went with the first option. He scaled back his proposal based on what he believed were reasonable concerns, but he still went forward with a fairly ambitious package, which was revived last night in the State of the Union.
He scaled it back, and he still got this. At this point, here we are in 2012. This was, again, Mitch Daniels last night with some of the Republican response on the Obama approach.
"The president's grand experiment in trickle-down government has held back rather than sped economic recovery. He seems to sincerely believe we can build a middle class out of government jobs paid for with borrowed dollars. In fact, it works the other way. A government as big and bossy as this one is maintained on the backs of the middle class and those who hope to join it."
There you go. There's the Republican pushback. Let's hear from our listeners. Angie in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Angie. You're on the air.
Well, hi. It's been wonderful listening to you, and we're about ready to have President Obama land at our airport any moment. I'm very supportive of what he's done and really enjoyed last night's State of the Union address. One thing that puzzles me, and maybe I'm looking at it too simplistically, is one of the reasons why we need to raise taxes, especially on that upper 1%, is we had some tremendous tax cuts during the Bush administration mm-hmm. while we were trying to fund a war. What I don't understand is, why aren't we mentioning that? I mean, is there some other reason why we don't mention that every time we're talking about raising taxes, that we had an unfunded war?
Well, the president did talk about those taxes very much last night. He's saying he wants to end those tax cuts, I think, for people $250,000 plus, not for those below. He didn't exactly link it to the war, but Cynthia Tucker, the president, was quite clear this time, though he's compromised before, in saying he wants those tax cuts to go away, Cynthia.
Yes, the president tried to give Americans sort of a thumbnail sketch of how we arrived at the situation that we're in. But he spent much of the time, rather than talking about how the Bush tax cuts helped set up the big debt, he talked about the recession. And then when he talked about tax cuts for millionaires, he didn't explicitly link that to the Bush tax cuts. There is only so much talking about the past he can do without Republicans accusing him of looking backward. You know, why don't you, you've been the president for 3 years now. Why don't you own up to this economy? But there was an interesting moment in the last Republican debate when one of the questioners explicitly asked about the Bush tax cuts. She said, if tax cuts do so much for producing jobs, why didn't the Bush tax cuts work? And I thought it was an interesting question. And I, too, have occasionally wondered why President Obama doesn't explicitly make that point more often.
Last night, sort of poking around it, not right on it, but ready, he said, to take those cuts away at the top. Drew in Buffalo, New York. Drew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I'm an Obama supporter. But I think I was mildly disappointed by the speech last night, and I'll tell you why. I like the metaphor you're using about the laundry list, but I was thinking more of like a shopping cart. And as I sat there listening to the speech, I was thinking that President Obama was filling this cart with a bunch of small little ideas, all of which are going to cost money, all of which we'll have to pay with a credit card, most of which won't be approved, and really don't add up to a solution to the problem. And I was hoping he'd talk in the big picture, talk about big ideas, you know, where we've been, where we are today, and where he'd like to see us be in the future. And then, you know, just describe three or four major ideas that are really the most important ideas and explain those in simple enough terms that we can all understand and really be a leader instead of, you know, the nitty gritty details of government that, you know, really didn't excite me.
Yeah, it's so always the tension in a State of the Union address. Drew, I appreciate your call. Doyle McManus, I think you're back with us. What about that? I mean, the president, he did try and lay out a big choice between his candidacy and whoever the Republican challenger is going to be. You know, Drew says in Buffalo, not big enough, not a big enough idea. Could the president win by going bigger? What would bigger be, Doyle?
Well, you know, I think this really was the president's attempt to do two things at once. I mean, he may have been caught in a catch-22. You know, in my view, if you look at some State of the Union speeches historically, this one actually was less of a laundry list than usual.
Didn't Bill have Clinton, school uniforms like Bill Clinton.
Oh, yeah. Bill Clinton once talked for 90 minutes and had so many mini programs we had to add new pages to the newspaper to get through all of them. You know, I think Drew is going to hear more focus of the kind he wants as the president gets out on the campaign trail. Now, that's no guarantee that he's going to like what he hears, but I think we did hear, you know, what will be the main core themes of the Obama campaign, and those include taxes. We've been talking about it already, the number one issue that's going to be fought over. Investment in infrastructure and education, and that intriguing new theme or semi-new theme of manufacturing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about the State of the Union, President Obama's perspective, his speech, his blueprint, his, in effect, campaign platform laid out for the country last night. Ryan Lizza from The New Yorker is with us, Washington correspondent there. Washington columnist Doyle McManus of The Los Angeles Times is here. Cynthia Tucker Long of The Atlanta Journal Constitution Pulitzer Prize winner there, now at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism, with us from Athens, Georgia. Cynthia, Ryan, Doyle, lots of response online. Greg says all he has is hate and divisiveness. That's the way he hears it. Richard says spectacular speech, made me feel quite patriotic. If he can keep it up, Republicans will have their hands full. Matt, you know, there's some jaded cynicism out there, too. He says rhetoric has changed, but my attitude,
But he's still got his hopeful enthusiasm, but Matt says he's got jaded cynicism now. And Jonathan, looking at Mitch Daniels' response to saying, we Americans are all in the same boat, Mitch Daniels says, Jonathan says, really, I don't think the yacht and its dinghy are the same boat. Okay, John in Nashville, you're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wish that the argument would be put in its proper context. I think the State of the Union address is fine, but it's still a bunch of talk. Americans want justice and fairness. To suggest we're dealing with class warfare, that is just a divisive approach to what's going on in this country. People are disgusted with the corruption and the lack of leadership. So it would be great if we dealt with, does in fact economics trump our political system? Do we not live in an oligarchy? This is where I stand. I'll take my comments off air. Thank you very much.
John, I appreciate your call. Doyle, do a little electoral analysis for you. Republicans clearly in their primaries are speaking to a different kind of voter than our caller John in Nashville. But when you get to the general election, what's bigger here? What's got more response in this country? The class warfare charge of the Republicans or President Obama's call for more fairness?
Well, that's certainly the right question. And we are certainly hearing, even in your listener's response, the kind of polarization we've been talking about. You're right that the Republican primary campaign that has soaked up so much of our attention is really a conversation that about one third of the electorate is having with itself. Mm. But even there, there are questions and debates arising of fairness, of corruption, of the undue influence of money in politics. And, this is an issue that was an enormous strength for Barack Obama when he ran as something of an outsider in 2008, his promise to come in and change the way Washington worked. On that score, when he is trying to appeal to independent voters, he has fallen way short of their expectations. And one of the things he needs to do is somehow rebuild some credibility on that issue. That's going to be tough to do, but I thought he took a very interesting couple of shots at Congress in that speech, and one of the proposals he made was to ban insider trading by members of Congress. That may be something of a sleeper issue.
Got a lot of applause. People have been really upset about stories of insider trading that Congress people have done going the other way. Ryan, Lizzie, you've been sort of looking inside the White House recently. How do they read this? I mean, the president's approval rating has been so low. I mean, I think nobody's been reelected with an approval rating that low. So does he have the handle on success here when he talks about fairness versus the Republicans' depictions of him as, inspired by the capitals of Europe and all that?
I think they see green shoots in two ways. One, there has been a string of positive economic news recently. Now, this has happened several times over the last 3 years. There have been these sort of false starts with positive monthly reports, and then the trend doesn't really continue or accelerate. But they're optimistic about that. Two, perhaps related to that, his approval rating has recovered a little bit recently. There's some positive trends in support for him and his approval rating. And then three, of course, is what they view as a circus on the Republican side, going on and on, and I think they would certainly be happy about the fact that the Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich contest is going to continue a little while longer. It would not have been in the White House's interest for Mitt Romney to have won South Carolina and sort of cruise to victory in Florida. They want the race to continue because they think that the further Newt Gingrich gets, the worse it is for the Republican Party. So I think those are the optimistic trends they see. And at the same time, those dynamics allow the president to do what he's going to do for the next few days, go out into the swing states and start selling the general election pitch that he laid out last night.
Cynthia, I want to bring that to you. Let me get Russ in Boston first. Russ, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I watched the State of the Union last night. I'm a Republican. Mm-hmm. And I was pleasantly surprised and liked a lot of what Obama was saying. What bothers me is that it doesn't add up mathematically. You can't do the sorts of things you want to do and fund that by just taxing the 1%. He's missing the main point about the peril that the United States is in right now, which is we've got 8% of the economy being financed by debt, and we're about to go over a cliff from debt. And he just didn't even talk about that key issue.
Yeah, Russ, let us pick it up. I appreciate your call. Cynthia Tucker, what about it? The president and the debt question. He did say take half our savings from war and apply them to the deficit. But there was a lot more on the let's do this, let's do that, which I guess means spending in terms of bulk in this speech than talk about the deficit, Cynthia.
Yes, there was. Now, he did also mention the deficit reduction rules that have already been agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that the president and his political team have made a bet on this election that the Americans to whom he is appealing are more interested in jobs than in getting the deficit under control. And those two things are certainly in tension. Every time you talk about giving somebody, some industry, a tax break, obviously that takes money out of the Treasury and increases the deficit. The president spent much of 2011 on the debt and deficit. All that happened was that he got beat up by Republicans, his poll numbers went down, and nothing much got accomplished. He alluded to the grand bargain that he tried to strike with John Boehner. Nothing happened. He alluded to the hideous fight around the debt ceiling. All that happened was that Congress's poll ratings went down as well, but the president's approval ratings began to drop. So I think he has made a bet that the Americans whose vote he has the best chance of winning are those who are most concerned about jobs and less concerned about getting the deficit under control.
John Boehner up on the dais, of course, next to the vice president, behind the president last night, studiously polite, but no jocularity there when the president looked to kind of, josh around with him a little bit at the beginning of the speech. Ryan, Liz, we were watching the others, cabinet members in the audience as well, in particular to this point on debt and spending, Tim Geithner with that perpetually sort of pensive, tense face of his. What do you think he was thinking as the president's laundry list rolled out?
I think he was thinking, he's the survivor. Of all of the members of Obama's team that I've met, nobody exudes supreme confidence more than Timothy Geithner. And remember, this guy's been on a roller coaster through this administration.
Yeah.
The laughing stock at one point during his nomination process because of his tax problem. He gave a very poorly received speech very early on in 2009, where the markets did not reflect well on, and he was sort of embarrassed by those moments. Has stuck around longer than any of the other members of the economic team. He's sort of a survivor. And if I'm reading him right, wants to leave this administration on a high note, not wants to leave it having completed his work and getting the economy on a path to recovery.
And leave it when, Ryan? Leave it when?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. But
everyone else is gone. Right.
Summers is gone. The director of the National Economic Council, the budget, the first budget director, Peter Orszag, is gone. Mm. The first CEA director,
and there was another note you were looking to make there, Ryan.
One other note, though, about the caller's point about taxes, and he's right. You can't raise the revenues that you need to fix the long-term deficit problem just by taxing the rich. It's just not enough revenue there. And this sort of tax cutting fever that really has been so successful on the right, you can't help but think that it's boxed Obama in a little bit too, because he has stuck to his pledge that he's had since the first day of his campaign, I believe in 2007, that he would get rid of the Bush tax cuts for those making over $250,000, but he would keep those middle class tax cuts. And there are a lot of smart people who look at the math here and say at some point there's going to have to be an agreement on a tax and spending proposal where those middle class tax cuts are on the table. Of course, if you have the president of the United States who won't touch them, and you have a Republican opposition who won't consider any tax raises at all, you're really gridlocked on that issue.
And maybe you come back and wait until the markets have their say. That's the song we heard last year. Doyle, I want to bring that to you. But first, Nathan in Tennessee, White House, Tennessee. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just a quick question and a point. if the Republicans are saying don't increase the taxes on the upper 1% mm-hmm. because they're the ones creating the jobs in America, point one, what jobs have they created? And two, why can't they create more jobs or create the jobs in lieu of paying taxes? And I'll take my listen to the comments off the air.
Well, Nathan, I appreciate your call. Doyle, there's some skepticism about the job creating record of that 1% that President Obama doesn't want to protect from higher taxes necessarily. Your Nathan's skepticism brings us back to where sort of the needle sits in this country on public attitudes here as the two parties compete.
Well, exactly. That goes straight to the core economic policy debate between the two sides, which is that, Republicans say in order to stimulate and encourage job creation by businessmen, entrepreneurs, investors like Mitt Romney, the best way to do that is to lower their tax rates still further, not just increase their tax rates, but lower the taxes on investment income. And Democrats don't buy it and think that money would be that it would be more fruitful to raise those tax rates a little bit and use that for investment. There's one other note that Ryan Lizza touched on that I want to go back to and hit one more time, mm-hmm. and that is, it's interesting to think about some of the subjects that were missing from this speech. When you look at the long-term debt and deficit problem, everybody on both sides of the aisle agrees that you're going to have to find savings in the healthcare system. You're going to have to find a more efficient way to make Medicare work. And most people think you're going to have to look at some changes over the long run in Social Security. But I didn't hear a lot of that last night. Those are painful subjects that are hard to talk about in a campaign season. And at bottom, this was, unsurprisingly, a kind of a campaign speech.
Yeah, not a lot about those, but the president saying, look, if you'll meet me halfway, I'm willing to talk about those again, but it's got to go both ways. Let's get another caller here, Walter in Salis, Mississippi. Walter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I would just like to say that, with Barack Obama, that he's done a great job being president of the U.S. We are diehard Democrats, in that area, and we watch like George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., Ronald Reagan, 8 years of Reagan, 8 years of George Bush Jr., 4 years of George Bush Sr. But we always, after those presidents are elected, we always stand back and wait. We don't cry foul, once Republicans go in office. We just wait and see what they're going to do. And like with Barack Obama, you had this Tea Party and the Republican administration that really never gave that man a chance door, when he first got into office, and I thought that was very unusual. And then too, I'm an over the road truck driver. I go all over the U.S. and now I begin to see shopping malls, people filling those malls back up. A lot of places that was out of work, people going back to work. New business coming up. A whole lot of energy, windmills, everything going. You can really see the economy turning around, out there on the highway now. You can't hardly move for trucks,
Walter, we got it. Our time is so short, but you're in the big rig, and from that high window, you see an economy coming back. I mean, Cynthia Tucker, as everybody knows, a lot is going to depend on that. The president looking to those green shoots, as Ryan Lizza calls them last night. But a lot will depend, whatever the rhetoric, on exactly on whether Walter's right or not, whether we got some comeback feeling out there in the economy in this country.
Absolutely. That's what will matter in this campaign season more than anything else. And we have been hearing and seeing encouraging signs all around for the last few months. Consumer confidence is slowly rising. That may help account for some of what Walter is seeing out there. A little more shopping going on, a few more new businesses opening. But there is a lot that can happen in the coming year, some of which the president has absolutely no control over. Europe and its debt problem is a big question mark. If that doesn't get under control, then that could come back and send the U.S. economy into a downward spiral again. So who knows what's going to happen on that front. There are green shoots now, but there's got to be a lot more rain and sunshine for those green shoots to sprout.
Doyle, the president presenting this as a big choice for the country about emphasis and equity. The Republicans doing the same. The president had the podium last night. How much confidence, or how tall a cliff do you see him having to climb this year? How much confidence can he look at this election with, or not, Doyle?
Oh, I think he's got quite a tall cliff to climb because of the state of the economy. Unemployment is going to remain stubbornly high all year. Even if those green shoots develop, it's going to be well over 8%. The president is going to have to ask voters to give him credit, not for the results so much as credit for trying. And that is a steep hill to climb.
Anyone who tells you America's in decline, they don't know what they're talking about, the president said last night. The country hoping that's true, but watching very closely at the same time, and there will be tough debate on the other side of this State of the Union address. Doyle McManus with the Los Angeles Times, Washington columnist there joining us today. Always great to have you, Doyle. Thank you so much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Tom.
Cynthia Tucker at the University of Georgia joining us from Athens, Georgia today. Cynthia, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Ryan Lizza, whose big current story in The New Yorker is the Obama memos. Ryan, you're terrific. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.